We're back again for Battleborn Duckers. Good thing we did that whole round 20 minutes. Without recording it.
You know what? You can tell you haven't been in the studio in a while when you just, forget stupid things, right?
I can't wait till we get older. We just constantly forget to push the button. And then we sit here and talk to each other for 2 hours.
We do that already. We don't need to get older. And we already do that. So, yeah. Man, it's been an eventful couple weeks.
Yeah, man. It's been a fun kickoff of the season. It's been good camaraderie with a bunch of good people getting out there chasing ducks. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we did. Started our Northeast opener in Nevada and went up around the Ely area and did a little bit of hunting up there. And then last weekend we started Southern Nevada. And so Southern Nevada opener we did Sunnyside to start with this year and had ourselves a little Battleborn Duck or Battleborn Beer Duck Camp. So
yeah, I mean, it was a good time. Everybody that we... If you listen and you came and visit us, we had a good time talking to you and sitting around the fire and telling lies, you know?
It's good, man. So
Brian's really good at making excuses for why he missed all the ducks.
Yeah, I was looking at your ugly face. Was number one. I was watching you miss. I was following your lead. Because I think the first hunt of the weekend, I think my numbers were better than yours, if I remember right.
It might have been. They weren't much better.
But no, I think it's – the cool thing about duck camp is we get – the opportunity to be around some people that we get to see not as often as we like some of them. Yeah. I know Sean Fairbairn was right next to us and camped right next to us. And so it's good to catch up with him and talk to those guys. And, you know, we had some really good guys in our camp with us that, you know, got to come out and have a good time and hunt ducks and tell stories and eat.
We had the gamut.
Food.
I mean, we had Joel that's been hunting for who knows how long. We have John that's been hunting longer than most of us have been alive. You know, and then we had Chris and Dave that this is their second year hunting, and last year they shot one duck between the two of them.
Yeah, and then you know, and it's always good because you get out there, and I'll tell you, it's a long weekend when you go. So we were on the road at 2 o'clock in the morning to be at our duck spot, first boat on the water,
up at 1:45, baby.
Yeah, up at 1:45, and the bad part is, you know, even with that, we knew it was going to be busy where we were at, and that's why we were up at 2 o'clock to get to our spot. But man, it's so easy to get a hunt ruined by somebody walking in 30 minutes before your hunt starts and ruin a hunt pretty dang easy. So
it's all public land.
It is. That's probably
what it is. You can't get mad. You just have to chuckle and say, well, this is what it is. What are you going to do?
Yeah. You can't do, I mean, you can't change it, but what you can do is, you know,
you
try
can.
To set yourself up.
You just not hunt on an opener.
You know, I think even if you, well, I guess.
If you hunt on a weekday, you ain't going to be out there.
Except for Overton. I mean, Overton, you're going to get nailed no matter what. So, but no, overall it was a good hunt. I think we started up in Ely and, you know, took Preston and Joel and Ricardo and we all went up and started that weekend off and, you know, few birds, but we notice the importance. Again, we talk about it every single time, is the importance of scouting and knowing where you're going to go. We'd scouted 3 weeks before. We were up there and we're like, let's see where we're going to want to go.
Yeah, the Key Pittman project, we went up there and we looked all around Ely.
Yeah.
And we found some great spots. We found some spots where the ducks were sitting. And we knew the ducks were sitting there because they're working an active banding project. And, you know the ducks are going to be where they're banding because that guy's been scouting that for months.
Yeah, and it's been, I mean, the other thing is the ducks see free food, right? So they're welfare ducks. And so they see free food.
Yeah, but in that defense, we weren't hunting over a bait pile because they pull that food. Like,
no, yeah. It's a couple weeks before they pull it, but those ducks get habituated to that area. And so they're comfortable being there and they feel safe there. And so we figured
there'd be. Not only that, they wouldn't put a trap there unless the ducks weren't there to begin with.
Yeah, and we figured it would be a good spot. And so we get up super early. We go run to the spot,
Oh, man, I'll tell you what, I don't like getting beat. And so, like, we headed to this spot, man, and I was just trucking. I was trucking as fast as I could. And I mean, I ditched Brian down the road and Joel down the road, and then I dumped my cart, and I kept on pulling another tote with Ricardo, and then I ditched Ricardo because I thought I heard a boat coming. And then my boot fell out of my waders. My foot fell out of my boot and my waders, and, man, I just face-planted right on the mud in the spot where there's tons of ducks, but no water now.
Yeah, and that's so we'd scout it 3 weeks before. We didn't have the opportunity to go and scout it because we had some work obligations we had to take care of. But fortunately, Joel had been up there early the day before. So on Friday, he went and scouted a bunch of spots and had found a secondary spot for us to go to where we knew now there was some water. Didn't have a ton of cover. That's the tough part. We probably hindsight, we might have been better bringing a boat in.
But after I'd rang all you guys, you fellas were tired.
Yeah. Yeah, it was tough. And so we didn't have...
There wasn't one person that didn't fall down in the mud that day. Fell down. Joe fell down twice. Preston fell down once. Ricardo was once or twice. So at the end of the day, we're all muddy and tired. And then we tried to tuck in and cover. And like the motivation just left.
Yeah, we still hunted pretty hard, and we still had a good time. It's
still
just,
shot ducks.
Yeah, still shot ducks, and everybody had a good time. And it's, I think those openers where there's a camper, you've got a couple guys around, even if it's, that one was five of us, which isn't huge, but we found a spot right close to where we were going to be and just kind of went in and ate dinner the one night all together. And it's a camaraderie thing that, you know, y'all enjoy each other's company. And
you know who didn't suck it on an opening day that day?
Who's that?
The Kowals.
Yeah, the Kowals.
Those sneaky mother effers.
Yeah, they smashed.
They freaking smashed a five. Well, I don't know if they want to tell me. They did really good. They shaved me.
Yeah, it was a pretty quick hunt for them. The problem is it's a quick hunt and then you're done for the day. You know, if you're done for the day in half an hour, that's your day. But you know,
well, you're not complaining though.
No, it was a good hunt.
I like when I get to stay out there all day and shoot one duck. I don't want to shoot them all in the first hour. That doesn't make any sense.
No, we all like to shoot ducks, and so it's fun. But then we moved down south last weekend, so we did Battleborn Duckers Camp, you know, and brought some Battleborn beer along with us, and you know, got to meet some new guys that we hadn't met before, and hang out with some old guys of the Fair Barons, and you know, we got to hang out with Jim and Pooh and Jim's wife Pooh cooked dinner for us two nights in a row, and so we had some nice Thai food and. That's always good. And so that one was a little bit bigger camp, and having the variety that we had with the young guys and John and Joel and just the experience you have in there.
Let me ask you a question. Would you rather have Jim and Pooh's Thai food, or would you rather have racks?
I don't know. I'm
come on, which one, Brian? You gotta make a decision. If you don't choose, Mitchell gets shot.
I like some. Mitchell gets shot. Oh, well, darn, then. I'm not going to make a decision. Well, I want to see this one play out. But no, I love racks, but I think especially if she's going to cook trout, there's no doubt about it. I'd rather have Jim's wife's food any day of the week. That's the best trout ever.
Oh, nice.
So
I don't know. I love that pork the next night.
Yeah,
that
the pork was delicious. The pork was awesome. The spring rolls were great. Racks is our go-to. If we're in Ely, we're going to go to racks at least once. And so even when I'm up there on business, that's dinner, right? So, but there's something to be said for somebody coming to your camp with a pot full of spring rolls and saying, you guys need to eat all this because I need my rice cooker back. So,
that was really good. That was a fun camp, man. We had quite a mixed bag of people in our camp.
Yeah, we got to sit around and, you know, everything's over and done. We got to sit around and have some Battleborn beer, you know, bring some guys in and let them try the best beer in Nevada, right? And so we got to do a lot of things and got to have fun. But, you know, the cool thing about it is this weekend is going to be youth opener down south in Overton. So we brought a couple kids in.
We brought two different types of kids. We brought my son, Mitchell. Mitchell, how many youth hunts have you been on?
Three.
You've been on three. And then how many hunts have you been on with me duck hunting? A lot, right?
Yeah.
What was your favorite hunt last year?
I'd say the youth opener.
Who were you with?
Nick Goley and two of my other friends.
Yeah.
You have friends? I didn't think you had any friends.
You have a lot of friends if you take people duck hunting. And then on
how much
do you
pay them?
Yeah, like at least a box, right? At least a box of shells is what it costs to get them out there. Excuse my voice, people. Brian's run me too hard these last weekends, you know. Anyways, and then we brought the other side of the spectrum. We brought Jed. And where are you from, Jed?
Idaho.
We brought Jed from Idaho.
And, he's in his own kind of Idaho.
And as you know, me and Brian are born and raised Vegas boys, and the third part of our production that you're going to see sometimes, Nate.
The not-so-silent-silent partner.
Not-so-silent-silent partner. He's from Utah, Idaho, and this is his nephew. And so they came all the way down from Idaho, which is a land of ducks. Did you know that?
Nope.
What?
Oh, dude, they smash it up in Idaho.
You got a lot of dookies up there. The Snake River. The Snake River, yeah. And I know that because at one point, one of our buddies... He shot more ducks himself than the whole WMA did at Overton the whole year. Himself. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I just want to make sure you know that. You guys drove down here to duck hunt. Do you feel good about your decision still?
Okay. I'm okay with that.
He just wants to win the gun. I think that's why he's down here. He wants to win a gun.
Yeah. New shotgun, huh?
Maybe.
So you've hunted a little bit up in Idaho, though, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What have you hunted up there?
Deer. I've tried.
Let me hear the deer story. What's the deer story? How'd that work out?
So we were up at our place. Mm-hmm. We went out with a buddy. We went up to one spot. Up by our hay.
Up by your alfalfa fields. Okay.
Yeah.
You can't hear me, but.
Yeah.
And then, well, we went up and then we saw a bunch of them, but they all ran off when we pulled up.
Oh, you weren't being sneaky enough.
Nope, not at all.
Okay. And then what happened?
And then we went to another spot and we just pulled up. There were, how far were they?
About 50 yards.
50 yards from the road, but we were driving up and they didn't move at all. We just kept driving until about a couple hundred yards.
You want to make it, give yourself a challenge. Don't take them at 50, take them at like 700.
Yeah, back up a little bit, huh?
Yeah. And then we got out of the truck, didn't really move, got down.
So you shot from a laying position then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
And then we just got down and shot him.
How did it feel, man? So did you have a scope or iron sights?
Yeah, scope.
What, were you shaking? Were you nervous or what?
He was super nervous.
Were you?
Yeah.
How did it feel when they dropped?
I honestly can't remember.
Was it like adrenaline? Like, oh, I did it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. When my boy shot his first one, I don't know who was more excited, my kid or Ron. But
I get
pumped. I think Ron screamed louder than everybody else. Screamed like a little girl.
This weekend, so Nate has told me that I am in charge of bringing you, Avi, my daughter, and Avery, and then Lila. So you're in my blind. All four of you guys, okay? The older kids that can shoot.
Yeah.
And if you shoot a duck, I will hoop and holler. I guarantee it. I get pumped. Like, Mitchell, tell them about your antelope hunt last year, how that worked out.
We didn't get one, right?
No, you did get one with Grandma and Grandpa.
Oh, yeah. He was so excited when we went.
So Mitchell's so experienced that he doesn't even know when he gets an animal.
No, and I didn't shoot it for him. He actually shot it. I'll tell the story. You want me to tell the story?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's antelope, and it comes out in the field, and it's standing right there. I get Mitchell out on the tripod, and I say, take your time. And in my head, I'm like, hurry up, go fast. I'm like, no, dude, just take your time. You're going to be okay. So I got angels and devils on my shoulder. And so Mitchell sits up on the tripod. He takes his time, and he finds it in the sight. It's like first shooting light, and goes, pop. And it was one shot, and that thing just tipped over. It was awesome. It was awesome. Kind of like yours, you know? Did it just fall over or did it run a little bit?
I think it just fell.
Yeah. Oh, man. That, there's nothing more exciting.
Nothing better than getting a good shot. And, you know, my kid's, his first one was, we were muzzleloader, and so it hit. That deer took one crow hop and then fell over to the side. That was it, you know? And so you're doing it, and you're doing it ethically. So if we're taking good shots like that and we're dropping deer in that first step, you know, that's always a good thing because we're not here to make animals suffer or anything like that. It's one and done, and you know, we can get to work. So
yeah, it's good animal management. So this weekend we're gonna Mitchell, you're gonna be with Nick Goley again.
Yep.
How have you liked hunting with Nick Goley?
I love it. It's best hunting ever.
So Mitchell will be with Nick Goley, and
it's because he puts him on ducks and like his dad.
I don't know. Last year, me and Mitchell and Avi and Beck had a good hunt up in Sunnyside, where it was all frozen over. And you want to tell them about it?
It was it was like big reeds, and how would you explain it?
Cold.
It was cold. Yeah, cold.
At one point, they went to go do a stalk on a frozen like marsh, and they're like, so I see Mitchell, Avi, and Beck just like shoe sliding across this ice with shotguns trying to get on canvasbacks. Oh. They didn't get on them though.
Yeah.
Anyways, so that was a fun hunt with my kids. There's nothing I enjoy more than hunting with either new hunters or kids, because it's just so satisfying to see them be able to harvest an animal. So hopefully this weekend, I've heard, is pretty good down there. I've heard there's a lot of pintails in. Have you ever, and a pintail, do you know about pintails?
No.
Tell me about pintails, Brian. What are they?
Pintails are, they're one of the biggest ducks that you're going to find. And so if they're right up there, I think they're even a little bigger than mallards. So we had giant, long, they got a long sprig on them. So that's why they call them sprigs. So it's a big, long, thin tail. And a giant melon on top of their shoulders.
And a big old long neck.
Yeah, so big old long neck, giant melon. But they're probably one of the best looking birds, I think. Personally, I think they're the best looking bird there. Yeah, they are. And, you know, the bad part about them is so they're very heavily managed. So it's one of those is all you're going to get for the day.
That's your limit.
That's your limit for that bird. But, you know, there's the cool thing about Southern Nevada, and I talk about it quite a bit. We've got to have these conversations with big players in the room. We were at SHOT Show with people like Ducks Unlimited and a bunch of the outdoorsmen and sportsmen that Nevada has such a variety of ducks. It's really hard to find the variety we have anywhere else that we have in Nevada. So you're going to have everything from super early season. You might see some blue-winged teal, which are very rare because they're usually gone by the time our openers hit. But then you're going to have gadwalls, widgeon, canvasbacks, redheads, ringnecks, mallards, pintails, I mean, just about anything.
You're not going to have very many widgeons.
We do get early season widgeon, though, and so you will get them. They're not super common, but we've harvested widgeons. And so, you know, even around the Las Vegas area, there was some a mandarin pair at one of the ponds out here.
But this is what's really cool about the pintails is that people travel to try to shoot these ducks. And so on Saturday, you might have the opportunity to shoot this. It probably won't be fully plumed, but you'll be able to shoot this pintail that people travel a long ways to shoot. And so that's the opportunity to get on Saturday. So we don't have a lot of ducks, but like Brian says, we have a huge mixed bag down there. And so it's going to be really fun.
Dude, hopefully you get a goose. That'd be the way to go.
Oh, yeah.
Get a goose first hunt, your very first hunt, get a nice little Canadian. And
you guys have goose in your field up there, though, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They probably have tons of geese to get up. Geese are super popular down here. But we're going to hunt you in the bull rush. And so the bull rushes at Overton are only about like hip or about knee deep at the most.
Well, for you, because you're short, but.
But yeah, so it'll be a fun walk out there. You'll have plenty of opportunity. It should be a really good hunt. And the best thing about it is it's opener. And so these ducks haven't been shot at all. So you might not have to be super quick on the draw. Might be able to get a duck that lands on the water that you're able to take some time with.
Yeah, usually opener, you'll get ducks come in early. A lot of times just sit on the water for 20, 30 minutes until you can get some light to shoot at them. So
yeah.
I think it'll be good. And the other thing is the cool thing about down here in Southern Nevada is the Overton opener. Endow does it every year. It was originally Wynn's idea that we came up with the Ducks and Donuts. Endow kind of took it over. And so they do donuts and hot chocolate and stuff in the morning. Then they do a raffle for the kids. So there's a ton of prizes. I know Wynn donated to it. I think Woods and Waters donated to it as well. They give out prizes. Number one prize is a shotgun. So everybody gets a chance to win that. And then you can come in 9 o'clock in the morning, you come back in and you have some pancakes. So we're lucky enough down south that we have an opener and a closer for youth. And so Endow does the opener. And then we sponsor with Wynn and Battleborn Duckers, we sponsor the closer. And that one, I mean, that one's a banger. We do duck call contests and everything for that one. So,
did you bring your shotgun down with you?
Nope.
Okay, that's good. That's good. So you can win the one there and just use that one.
Yep, I guess.
That's the plan. That's the plan. Well, Brian, we have some. Do you have something?
I was just going to say, so Jed has been, he joined the Raft River Trap Club. So,
oh, really?
At his age 11, so he's the youngest one in the team. But it's kind of funny because the trap club there at Raft River in Idaho, the kids will bring their guns to school.
Oh, really?
Dead serious. And the principal just says, if you bring your gun to school, you have to park not on school property. So you can tell who has all their guns because they're all parked on the road. And they're just, that's just the way we are up there in Idaho, where kids can actually bring their shotguns to school, leave them in their truck, and then after school they go do the trap shoot.
So Idaho's still a conservative place, yeah. But California's trying to fix that.
It gives me hope, man. It gives me hope.
Hope out in the world.
California's trying to fix that for you, though. But see, the thing is, what happens is in Southern Nevada, we've got more of the L.A. scene kind of move in, and then Northern Nevada, up around the Reno and the Idaho area, you guys are getting that Northern California group, which is a more conservative group in general. But that's the cool thing about it is we tried that in Nevada. So my son was, when he was in high school, he wanted to bring. So there's a national high school shooting league, and mm-hmm. it's a trap league. And so he wanted to bring it, and the principal told him no. And so it was either you have a choice. You either sue him or you just go find somewhere else. And he was already shooting 4-H pretty heavy anyways. And so we just stayed with that. But realistically, somebody's going to have to sue him because they're required by law to provide for the club and this and that. But that's the hard part is the answer that he gave is no, because we can't have schools associated with guns. And so
you already are surprised. Yeah, it's bad ways.
And part of the thing that we have to think about is when we do this, these youth, if we don't teach them how to do it properly, they're not going to know. And then that's when we have the issues, which is why Ron and I started the Win You Sportsman's program is give those kids the opportunity to learn about it the right way and put it to practical use. And then it changes the way you think about things. My kids had guns in their rooms at a very young age. Their guns have always been in their rooms, but they're also competition shooters. And so they know how to respect the guns and what they're used for. And so we're not doing ourselves any favors by banning guns from schools and not letting kids have trap teams and stuff like that. Idaho's one of the coolest places for the sportsmen. There's just so much opportunity and availability there. You know, my boy, I sent him up there. My father-in-law's from Idaho. So they're from Winchester, Idaho, and they do a hunting camp every year. He's been up for 2 months. I've had his dog for 2 months. I'm ready to kill it now. So, but we'll go up there, and I sent my boy up there.
Chinatown, they'll pick it up.
Yeah, no doubt. We'll have Thai food with it. But I sent my boy, and they had the four-tag deal where you get one tag, and once you shoot one animal, you can go on to the next one. And he ended up with an elk and a whitetail out of it, got a shot off on a wolf, and didn't see a bear. So, I mean, you have the opportunity in Idaho to do a lot of hunting relatively cheap as a kid. And the ducks and geese are just they're something different up there. So,
have you cooked up your deer yet?
Yeah.
What'd you do? How'd you cook it?
Yeah.
So you have to remember this deer. She basically was living on alfalfa fields her entire life. And in the wintertime, we have problems with deer getting into our haystack.
Yeah.
But so we shot her. We cooked her up. And seriously, I've had duck that's tasted more wild, more gamey than this deer has. Just beautiful, really, really good meat. And so we're actually looking at trying to get depredation tags for next year.
Yeah.
If we want to, because that's an easy way to, because we just hunted on our property. We just kind of drove around and basically until we can find a herd of deer that wouldn't run away when we stopped truck. Yeah. And so, but yeah, we have quite a bit of deer up there that get kind of habitualized to human contact, which is fine. We love them. We love to see the deer. You know, they do get into like our strawberry patches the summer that they did.
And they are nuisances.
They can be, but I'd rather see them there than not.
Well, that's why we have depredation tag programs is mm-hmm. to help the farmers and ranchers offset those. Some of that damage. And so in Nevada, it's huge. So your depredation tags are going to, they're going for sale and, you know, you're selling tags for $30,000-$40,000 at times, you know? And so that's an opportunity for that rancher to make up for that lost hay. And what people don't realize is ranching and farming is not an easy job. So,
well, not only that, they don't realize that the reason why Nevada still has a deer population is because the farmers are putting out that alfalfa and they're keeping our deer herds alive.
Yeah, that's the only.
If forage. It wasn't for the farmers, we wouldn't have a deer population because of the mismanagement of horses, of the mismanagement of other big game species. Like the reason why we have deer populations, you could thank a rancher because they have the feed and they don't allow other animals to get to it.
Well, there's two groups. There's two groups in the United States that are responsible for most of your opportunity to hunt and view wildlife. And those two groups are your farmers and ranchers, because in a state, especially like Nevada, where the drought's so bad and the forage is so limited in places, that's their only forage for a lot of times. So those ranchers are keeping those herds alive. But the other opportunity is, man, the sportsmen groups in these states that most of them are made up by hunters, And our money goes to Pittman Robertson and it comes back and we use that funds. But I will tell you, as the president of Wynn, we've come in and our goal this year was $100,000 of impact. We had some money from our banquet, but just in labor on a project, we were $30,000, $40,000 in labor on just one project. And so on top of the amount of time we saved the Endow staff, the management staff, that they didn't have to pay their employees. So that one project was close to a $50,000 project. And if we didn't do these projects, then there's no water sources for these. So we're developing water sources where they're historically not, and putting drinkers in so we can keep water tanks so the deer have water to come back to. And so if we don't have these farmers and ranchers, and what bothers me is we have scientists in our management organizations that view the farmer and the rancher and the sportsman as a derogatory term.
We don't say the deer. We put masks on all of them.
Well, and it's like, well, you know, it's not even derogatory towards that. It's the derogatory term of they turn citizen scientists into a derogatory term because our input isn't important because we didn't go to school. Well, we're seeing the deer populations decline. Mm-hmm. We know if we walk into a healthy herd, we know what a healthy herd looks like. Yes. They know what a healthy herd looks like by a book from a book. Or I came from Minnesota and this is how we're going to manage deer in Nevada. Well, it's not the same state. We don't have the same issues. We've seen the deer as a hunter. You go back to the same areas. You tend to put in for the same areas year after year.
You know all the water holes, you know all the fees, you know all the canyons.
And you know the deer that were there the year before. And
well, you've seen herds.
It's interesting too, where we are at. Like last year we had a huge herd, like, in the wintertime, we'd see them. They all gather up in the wintertime, right? And we probably, I counted one day, like 60 does all together. But this year, we haven't seen as many, and we were trying to figure out why is that? Why did we lose our deer population that's in and around our property and farm? And partly it was because our neighbor to the south of us, he pulled out all of his alfalfa fields and he put in barley. And he has probably about 1,000 acres of barley, just straight barley.
Ducks will love it.
Ducks will love it, but the problem was is that those deer were used to having all that alfalfa that they could just eat. And so this year, I probably counted maybe about 30. It's about half the population. And we're living down in the valley of where we're at. And normally we have a lot of problems with cougars. But where they're down in the valley, a cougar really can't get onto a deer very easily because they're... It's flat. They can see them coming. And so that's the only thing we can suggest, understand is why we don't have that population drop so dramatically is, you know, they moved off to someplace else where they can get better and easier feed all winter.
Yeah. And you guys have some of the same issues we do in Nevada, but not probably with the drought as bad, but predation here. I mean, so we've had...
Well, they put all those wolves in Idaho too.
Yeah. Well, so the wolf population, wolf is one of the most ferocious predator is alive, so they'll kill for sport. They won't even eat it, just kill it. In Nevada, we've got the mountain lions, and so mountain lion, cougar, panther, whatever you want to call it, right? So we've got the mountain lion issue in Nevada, and what's happened is the anti-trappers have really decimated the ability for trappers to really go out and do their job on that side. And then the coyote population, you know, we're trying to shut down all these competitions and stuff like that, so the coyote population isn't in check anymore.
True.
And then add to that, we have the largest wild horse population in the United States, in the driest state in the nation.
It's ridiculous.
And so the herd...
I'll take a few up with you when you go back home, well, man.
Going on with that, fur bearers, too, they've actually done studies showing that for ducks, the best way to maintain duck populations is to get rid of those miso predators, like the raccoons, the possums, the... Those little animals, those not like the big wolves or other issues.
Them nest robbers.
But they're nest robbers.
The nest robbers, exactly.
If you want to save ducks, you got to get rid of those.
Tell them about what raccoons do with wood duck nesting boxes.
Yeah, they'll make an omelet, basically. So they'll get into the nest and they'll just... They'll smash the eggs all around and they take...
They can't get the eggs out. They can't get the eggs out.
So they'll smash them and just lick their paws, you know.
You have no idea. Like, we had a raccoon get into one of our chicken coops and we had a little hole that it got into. But because it couldn't get out with the chicken, it killed 44 of our hens. Just killed them. Just left them on the ground.
Yeah.
Went for another one. Left them on the ground. because they couldn't carry the chicken out of the chicken coop, and so they just decided to just, you know,
slaughter.
To slaughter.
Well, and that's
wholesale slaughter. It was.
We've been really putting.
How pissed were you, man?
Oh, I was. The pissy thing was that they were 4 months old, and so they're just about ready to start laying eggs.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what they would do? And there's a lot of, like, even with turkey populations too, like turkeys, they'll tend to lay on their brood, you know, to keep them warm, you know, go off just to feed. But sometimes they'll even take out turkeys too.
Oh yeah, so we have
when they're laying, that's even worse.
So
it's less turkey and all their eggs. So
when you guys are out for this hunt, we have one of the best turkey populations in Nevada. Mm-hmm. It's sitting at that management area, so we take state record non-typicals out of there on a regular basis. Uh-huh. And they had not put the missile predators in check. Mm-hmm. And the turkey population was being decimated.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so they started bringing in a federal trapper. Mm-hmm. And so now
you're paying money to
a lot of money to do it. And
that.
So we finally have hopefully got them on the idea of, with our WIN organization, we've actually, we call it Fund a Trapper. Mm-hmm. And so we've paid a trapper and a couple different management areas to say, hey,
this is going to be half the amount.
Yeah. This is going to be
not even half. I don't know. We paid him a pittance.
Yeah, we paid him for gas, basically. We paid him just for about
they
gas.
They want to trap anyways, and we're like, hey, listen, if we give you some money, will you trap here?
And the cool thing is that now we're going to get it. It's going to cost my organization some money, but we're going to get that input for free. And then we work with the management area managers, and then they can tell them, hey, this is where I want you to trap. And so we specified that these are the species that are our target species. Yep. And, you know, funny thing is that one of them, he's been begging to get on this WMA for years, and they wouldn't let him on. And so he was going to do it for free. We offered him the chance to do it, and not only do it, but do it and get compensated to do it. And then so we can control that. And so what we've seen is just with the government trappers, the turkey population's exploded again,
yeah.
which is a great thing. But we still are seeing issues with ducks, and it's a raccoon issue and it's a skunk issue for us. And that's our big ones. I mean,
it's not even a coyote issue.
Not even a coyote issue. No. And the coyotes do. So once they hatch out, the coyotes will do some damage,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they can. But they're not going to go out.
You got little
the
chicken
water.
Nuggets
yeah.
running around.
Yeah, they're like, oh, this is snack time. And so I can get 10 snacks here in a minute. But, you know, and the funny thing is these WMAs, there's so little pressure on the predators in these WMAs. Mm-hmm. That because you can't hunt them, you know, you can hunt for waterfowl and stuff like that. Most of them you can't hunt, you can't rifle hunt. So I literally have had
someone tell us they got a ticket last year for shooting coyote in their blind.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think it was in Overton. I can't remember, but they wrote him a ticket. And so I've had coyotes. I couldn't figure out why.
It is blind.
How does that work where it's on public? Because
you're shooting a shotgun before.
Because you're in a management area that the rules in the management area say shotguns only.
Well, so
I was shooting for X
rifle?
Amount of time.
So actually, you can't shoot coyotes at all. So coyotes are off limits during that season, I think, is what the deal is.
Oh, yeah.
You can't
it's
shoot,
only ducks.
You can't
shoot quail or dove.
Yeah, you can't shoot quail, dove, or rabbits. So, but the funny thing is it's you'll have an incident. Like I was hunting one day, and I couldn't figure out why the birds were flaring. And it was just early hunting time. So it's still a little bit dark out. You can't see everything. Mm-hmm. And as the sun came up, there was a coyote pacing the dike right across from me. And so you can't shoot them. So the only thing you can do is try to harass them enough to get off of there. So ducks would fly anywhere near me where they're in vision. I'd shoot just to try to scare that coyote off. But we haven't had them. And what we're talking about is these federal trappers would come in and they take 5 or 6 cats out of a WMA in 2 weeks. You know, and so
they can't keep them.
They can't keep them. Yeah, they have to let the cats go.
Wait, like
feral
stupid. Cats too?
No, bobcats.
Bobcats, okay. So that's what I was going to say, too. That's another big issue is feral cats.
Like yeah.
They have
feral cats are the biggest decimator of the bird population in the United States.
The United States, North America, period, too.
So, and that's a big thing. People, you know, these feral cats get out and they'll ruin birds, right?
Any type of bird that you can get their hands on.
And you know, it's funny because you got people that I honestly think that the antis think they're doing a good thing, mm-hmm. but they just don't know the science behind it, right? So, the reason the sportsmen are here is because that's how we're managing these populations of wildlife.
Yeah.
And so what we've done is we've come in and wolves are a beautiful animal, don't get me wrong. But we've put wolves and reintroduced wolves into areas, and it's completely changed the landscapes of the areas. And now the predators that were around are a different predator, and you're losing so many more animals. And when you lose those animals, then every other animal suffers because of it. Yeah. So they're all dependent on each other. So we do things, our Wildlife Division is notorious for doing things without thinking about it.
Well, they think about it. I just don't know if I agree with their thoughts.
Well, they put – so we had the best bass fishery in the United States in Nevada. Really? We had. It was the first Bassmasters tournament was at Lake Mead.
Really?
In Nevada. And then they
–
Largemouth bass.
Wow.
So and we had largemouth, smallmouth, and trout. Indow decided that we needed another game species. And so the striped bass would never be able to procreate in Lake Mead because the temperature variation of the water was too great. So within 2 years, we almost lost our entire bass population, and the striper was the only thing that's left. We still have some in certain areas, but it's not the fishery it was. Really? And now striper and carp have taken over that lake. And so, and striper are another one. They're like the wolf. So a striper will eat and eat and eat. And then when it can't eat anymore, it'll puke up everything it ate so it can eat some more.
Really?
So you get them to where they're not, you can't keep them in check. And so we did the same thing with the tamarisk beetle. We have a tamarisk tree and it's an invasive tree. So they decided we're going to release this beetle and it will move super slow and it will kill these trees. And well, within 2 years, it had covered the area that they thought it was going to cover in 20 years. And so now there's dead vegetation and, you know, we have a greater risk of fires. And so the intention's great. But they're not doing enough research to figure out what the end game is going to be. And so as conservation groups, we go in and we try to do things that are going to just augment what we have. So we're not going to come in and introduce things, but we are going to come in and bring water in or bring animals that were traditionally on the landscape. We'd like to see some of them return. So I'd like to see pheasant back down in southern Nevada. And they brought some pheasants down. But the problem is, you have to do it the right way.
You need wild pheasants that we brought in.
Yeah,
you have to do a trade program with like Utah or Idaho.
But they brought in the pheasants, and the first year they opened them up to hunting. And so you get like two pheasants a day, and then that was it. Well, you can't do that. You have to get a population started, and you got to get established and grow. So bring the pheasants in for 5 or 10 years, and then allow hunting and a hunting opportunity out pheasants.
Don't bring in farm raised pheasants. Yeah. Bring in wild pheasants.
See, that's what we're looking at doing down at our place is starting with farm raised pheasants and then let them. I don't know the exact age, but let them get up so big and then let them go so that they're not habitually.
Well, if you're doing a traditional hunt farm, that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, if you're doing a traditional hunt farm, that's what people pay for.
No, we're not. I don't want to do. Hey, I just want to see my land.
Well, here's the problem with birds and pheasants and stuff like that is so they've done a lot of studies on farm raised birds.
Yeah.
And they say it's like a 20% for a wild bird is 20% of them are going to survive. When you start getting farm raised, you're looking at 4 to 5% maybe.
Well, I looked at some ways that you can do it is where basically you take the
cage and put it out in the field and let that's a much better environment. It's still lower. If you can get wild trades, and that's what the states need to do is get wild trades. Because it's almost like you leave them put them on a landscape and they don't know what to do, right? Yep. And so they die and they're stupid because they don't have any predators around.
Yep.
At least if they're caged in an area, the same predators are going to be there when you release them are going to be there. They're going to be around. So they're going to be wary.
It reminds me a lot of like when you have like a pet rabbit and your dog kills it, you know, like because it's never seen a dog before. And so the dog just walks up and like kills it because it doesn't know what a predator is. I'm sure that's what those wild pheasants are in the field. Like, they're sitting there in a coyote. He's like, oh, look at this.
Snap.
Gone.
Well, like, it's funny because I've been out, when I was out cutting alfalfa, I kept seeing this hen jump out of the field, out of the alfalfa, after I cut the hay. She'd jump out, and then she'd jump back into the hay. I was like, what's going on with this? You know, what's she doing? So I'd come back around the next time, and she'd do it again. And so finally I realized, oh, she probably got a little bit of a clutch of chicks. So I stopped the tractor, got out, and walked through the field and kind of pushed her out because I was like, I don't want to kill this bird because I know she's going to have, you know, 6 or 7 chicks with her. So I stopped the tractor, walked through there, flushed her out, and she kind of flew out a little ways. And all of a sudden, boom, here comes 6 or 7 little chicks coming right behind her. It's like, most guys, I don't know, for the most part, most guys won't do that. They'll just keep going.
Yeah, and it's
isn't that what they say? Organic food's not organic.
Well,
or like vegans eat more meat than hunters.
Yeah,
and that's the thing is
it's like being looking at what you've got and you know, being mindful of what. And that even happened to me with deer too. There was one day I was out cutting hay and I saw this doe. She just stood there and she kept looking in the same spot. I was like, "What is she doing?" So I just get getting closer because we're cutting on a pivot. So we're just out on, we start on the outside and move our way in. And she's, as I was cutting, she just kept looking at the same spot all the time. And so I was like, what is going on? So I got, you know, I stopped, got out of the tractor and kind of walked out to where she was looking and found a little baby fawn that was just sitting there in the alfalfa field. And I was like, okay, what do I do with this? So I was able to like slowly scare it away, got it up and take it off with its mom. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know how bad that would be with my swather if I would hit
Fawn. Well, it would have damaged the fawn and your swather. So
it wouldn't do much to the swather, of course. But I was just like, I wouldn't want to have that on my head.
Where... So something I've heard is like if, and someone was telling me, is if when you're cutting your fields, if you leave a hedge by your fence, which no farmers like to leave.
Well, you don't do that with the pivot because it's all one big.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're like, if you leave hedges by your fence, then the animals have places to hide. But a lot of farmers don't like the hedges by their fence. And...
Well, that's the, and that's the thing is you look at, it's funny because you hear all these things, we got to eat, we got to go vegetarian because it's the cleanest way to eat. Well, if you could imagine what it takes to grow crops for food, mm-hmm. and the animals would get killed just to grow crops for food,
there's nothing in comparison. Salad, you don't even know.
Yeah. Well, I've hit ducks, a duck in one of my fields too. I don't know what it was doing because it was nowhere close to the river. And oh, that's my phone, but just a second.
And that's the thing is
you're good to go shut it off real quick.
The ducks and the birds and the, you know, the rabbits and mice and everything else that's in there.
Though, like if most ranchers and farmers knew what they have available to them, like most people would kill to be able to drive around their field, their property, stop, get out of your truck, shoot a deer, then drive right up to it, gut it right in, you know.
Unfortunately, we're our own worst enemy as sportsmen because we do really stupid things like go in when you're not invited and cut locks and leave gates open
or shoot at pivots. Like, shoot at pivots. That's what all the farmers say. They say, my pivots always get messed up when you guys get down there, man. I can't have you in there.
The other thing, too, is we have one year, last year, we had a guy come in, asked us if we could hunt our property. He's like, sure. But he brought his brother with him. It was like, we will ask for one person, but here comes two guys out there, shoot two bucks.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you asked to hunt our property. That's fine. I can accept that, but don't bring your brother or don't bring your whole group.
Or let us know.
Yeah. Well, not even let us know. It's like how, I don't know if I'd rather have, you know, a whole family, you know, everyone have a duck tag come down and hunt our property.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing is it's like, but what I've noticed is if you approach it the right way, and you're polite and you make relationships before you ask, then you're going to be more apt to be able to hunt it. We've had a guy chase us down. We were scouting for ducks and he chased us down when we drove past us because we drove past his ranch twice. He chased us down to see if we were hunting antelope because he wanted us to take the antelope off his field.
We just had a similar experience, Mitchell. Tell him how many doors you knocked up in the Ruby Valley.
We knocked on a lot.
We knocked the whole valley and Mitchell got permission on how many places.
One or two?
Two.
See,
and he knocked like 50 doors.
Well, the other issue is,
but it wasn't like they're like, no, you can't hunt. They're like, hey, we already promised somebody, we already have this. Or
we'd rather have a kid that we know come shoot. Which I like. For me, I'd rather see someone in their valley come shoot a deer off of our field that we know that we get to see him all the time.
Exactly.
Well, and it's interesting too because we actually are starting to get an established antelope herd in our valley. This is our little valley that we are. And so it's kind of cool to see. And it's like, I don't want to have some hunters come down and, you know, knock out these antelope because they're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just starting to get established. You know, there's
that's going to blow up on you so bad, man. I want to talk to you here in 5 years. There's going to be so many.
But then I'd rather see them, I'd rather see them on the landscape because they were already there before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's part of.
I love antelope. They're cool animals.
But that's part of appropriate management, right? So we have to set some limits and we have to set some boundaries. And we had a case, a rancher from up in northern Nevada. He's like, man, I've let people hunt my property every year. He goes, but I go to my gates and they cut both of the locks and they stole the lock and chain off of the one. So now I got to replace the lock and the chain. And then they left the gates open. You know, and people don't realize, especially if you're grazing ranchers. Cattle. And so you get a herd out, it's a nightmare. They do it enough on their own. We don't need your help. And so my family runs 300,000 acres of cattle, and it's, you know, those issues, a fence is down, it's going to take you 2 or 3 days to get your cows back in. You may lose,
or you never know where
they're 5 or 10 of them, yeah. You know? And so, and at 5 or 10 of them and a couple grand, that's a lot of money for these ranchers, and they're living on thin margins to start with. And so every time we do something like a pivot, I don't even know what a pivot costs anymore, but
about 80 grand.
So you go out and you're starting
to shoot. How much does it cost to repair a pivot?
It depends on what damage
you do. Let's say they shoot the main arch and spraying water out.
That's kind of an easy fix. You can kind of patch stuff like that. But, you know,
how long does the patch last, though?
Not that great. Depends on the type of patch you put on. But, like, we've had our wheel line shot. It's like no one had access to our wheel lines. Like there's no one that came down and hunted in our wheel lines. Somehow we got this hole in our wheel line. We were trying to figure out what happened, but I don't know what really did. So
how much was that repair?
That wasn't. We just replaced it with another.
Yeah. Another
well, it's funny because we were out doing some deer hunting, some youth deer hunting, and the Mormon Church has a ranch up by the area that we hunt, and there were 3 antelope in the field that somebody shot. After they'd asked for permission, told them they couldn't get them. So, you know, and that's the bad part is people will just do it, and people are just ignorant.
There's a lot of problems with people shooting like transformers up on telephone poles up where we're at. They go out hunting, don't see anything, so they just shoot.
Ours is
the white things that are on the top of the telephone poles.
So ours are water tanks. Mm-hmm. So we live up in we're an hour outside of Vegas, and it's desert around there. But our water tank has several bullet holes in it. Yep. And now it's a $10 million job to replace the tank.
Wow.
And so,
They just patching it, Brian?
No, they're replacing the tank. And so they are getting government funding from the state of Nevada because they can't afford it as a small utility. And so all of us are paying for it because people can't.
Well, Phil, let me ask you a question, man. Sure. How, if someone were to approach you, how do you want to be approached? What's the right approach to ask a farmer to hunt their land?
Usually I'd like to have them ask before opening day or, it's like, hey, come a week before. It's like, hey, we're scouting this round. We'd like to come hunt your property. But I'm still kind of hesitant because I know that because I see the deer every day, I can look out my backyard and see the herd of deer. I'm kind of more hesitant to allow hunters because especially just recently, within the last 10 years, we've started to get our mule deer herd on our property. And so it's like before that, they were never there. And so we're just starting to get that established. And so it's like to have someone come in and want to hunt them because they're there. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard for me to say, give people the approval to come hunt our property because I'd rather see, the deer get established.
What if someone offers you like a trespass fee? Like they walk up and they say, hey, Phil, I'd like to hunt your farm. I'll pay you $100 for access. Mm-hmm. Would that sway you in either direction or no?
Well, $100, it would be okay. But I think a lot, it's like if you want to really help out a rancher, it's like, hey, can I come up and I'll fix your fence? Like tell me what fence you want me fixed and I'll spend a day. Like that would go so much farther for ranchers to want to let people on your property.
I'll come stack hay for
if I had a guy come out and say, hey, I'll fix your fence or tighten up your fence, this line. It's like, if you want to do that for a day, spend a day, sure, come hunt my property. And it doesn't take a lot of knowledge to learn how to do that.
But. No, and it's kind of a tit for tat thing, and that's what the ranchers, the ranchers, like all of us, the most valuable resource Ron and I have is time.
Exactly. It's like, we don't need $100. You could take that $100 and spend it just fast, but yeah. I don't have time to go fix my fence.
And that's a big thing. And I think when we do it, when you're talking about the ranchers and stuff, I think it's important to build the relationship before you give an ask, right? So if a guy comes and says, hey, I see you got a bunch of hay over there, I'll stack hay for you if you give me access. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that is important that we have to realize is you talked about the herds just starting to get established. Mm-hmm. So if you see the guys that do the duck world the right way, so they'll have a piece of property, they'll have 3 or 4 or 5 leases, and they'll let them go 2-3 years sometimes in between hunting them, and then they only hunt them once or twice a season, because if they hunt them 5 times, 6 times, 7 times in a row, the ducks are gone, and they're not coming back for a long time. And so if we get that established, and then you control, you know, what you're taking out of there and how often you're, how much pressure you're putting on it. You put pressure on animals, they're going to go because that's their instinct. It's not safe anymore. And animals are there because it's a food source and it's a safe place to be. They can watch the predators. Now, if I got every year, I come to the same place and now 10 of my buddies just died, you know, I'm probably not going to go.
No.
You know?
Exactly. And they know the time of year that's going to be most pressured. And they, you know, going back on your thing is like, I'd be okay, but I'd rather have, not to be, you guys don't push this, but I like the Onyx Hunt app because it can show property line. It's like, you can hunt my property, but just realize you can only hunt this section. Like, I give you permission just for this section. And these guys who came and hunted, I know that they hunt, because it was on sagebrush, and there's not a really defined fence, and there was a fence there before my time, but they shot a deer on my wife's uncle's property, and we gave them permission to hunt on our property, but because they didn't know where they were, you know, they basically...
Onyx is one of the best tools in our toolbox, to be honest with you. Exactly. I mean, we use it not only just for boundary lines, because cool thing about Onyx is you can find the property owner.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can make a phone call. Mm-hmm. You can do some research and figure that out. But we use it to, if we're in a spot, so we have some spots that we found that hold water that nobody else knows about. And we just happen to walk in on, or we'll do, I'll look at the map. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll pull up the aerial and I'm like, that looks like it might be a good place to hunt.
Yep.
And so Ron might find a spot. He'll mark it and send it to me. And he goes, what do you think about this? And so everywhere we've kind of hunted, we've kind of picked out our spots and marked them. And then if you, like for us going up to the Ruby Valley, we actually tracked our way in and tracked our way back out. You're going to get lost if you don't.
In the marshes, yeah.
In the marshes. So it's such a valuable tool. And the cool thing about it is it's so versatile, right? You can see what the property boundaries are. You can see what the government land is. You can see your hunt units. You can see all that stuff. It's all there. There's no excuse for somebody being on private property.
And it's like coming from the property owner who has the resources, because we have pheasants. We have ducks typically sometimes in the spring. I like to see the ducks in the spring because it's really cool. And we have deer. Occasionally we have elk. There are sometimes I was cutting third crop alfalfa on our pivot, and a whole herd came right into our field while I was cutting it.
That's awesome.
They're basically, with elk though, they, in our area, they don't stay very long. They're constantly moving. But it's just that I can see as a property owner having the value of not being pressured, because the deer that are there, they're not pressured. You know, they're not out, versus other deer that are in the same valley that's all on public property. Man, you even stop your truck to, you know, to stop and look, they're gone. They're used to having trucks just keep going. And so as a property owner, it's like, it's that fine balance of allowing people access to your property, but like having them to respect your property and to realize it's like, yeah, you come one day or once a year to come hunt when we get to see these animals year round, and we get to see the fawns in the spring. We get to see them grow.
That's one of the few perks of being a rancher and a farmer, right?
Yeah,
it is. It's you have the wildlife there, and that's one of the great perks about that. And so we have to realize that, you know, these aren't just people's houses. These are people's livings. Yep. And so that's a big part of it. And if we can get people to help manage herds, we're going to have to reduce numbers at some point. And I guarantee you, when the antelope come in and they're 70 deep in your field and they're going through as much hay as you can sell, you're going to beg somebody to come in and hunt it. And then that's where your opportunity is. And then the other thing is, I think Mitchell, and I can tell you for a fact, Mitchell would have a much better opportunity to be able to hunt private land than Ron and I would.
See, and that's the way I feel too, is as a property owner, hypothetically, I'm not the property owner. My father-in-law owns a lot of
rancher.
Property. But like, I would rather see a kid come in and shoot a deer than I would see a person who's hunted all their life. Granted, I don't know, because I can't, you know, tell how long they've been hunting. Like, I feel, I get more joy about seeing a kid come down and hunt our property than, you know, someone. And the other thing, going back on this whole idea, is that I've actually done studies on deer And if you want big bucks with big racks, what they've found is that if the doe is, while she's pregnant, the higher, the more fat she has while she's pregnant, the bigger bucks they are. I mean, they've switched them out, you know, a doe that typically throws smaller bucks, put them on crappier or better feed, basically, she'll throw bigger bucks. And so, yeah, us ranchers and us farmers, you know, we're providing those big bucks that you see, versus having them out when they're, you know, barely living. You know, March is the worst month for deer because, one, they're pregnant and they're like at the end of the food source, to have, you know, a place that they can go and get feed. And you don't want to be like they have up in Jackson Hole where they, you know, they basically fed elk, you know, they had done the feeding. Have you guys ever been up there to see?
No.
Oh, you guys, just to see, like they basically all winter long, they feed elk outside of Jackson Hole, this alfalfa pellet, because they started it and now they've got a problem because
now they're habituated to it.
Habituated for the last 30 years. I'm not exactly sure how long, but it's been at least 25 years since I went up there in ninth grade, in junior high. And they just feed the elk, and they've basically had, you know, they've been habituated that they don't leave. Like, that's the only way that they've can survive in the wintertime is because of that.
So, yeah, let me ask you another question. Sure. Besides fixing fence, what are some other things people could suggest to do?
Fix.
Is it fence? Is that the main thing? Like, fence is what I need.
Pretty much the fence, because, you know, most farmers, we have like miles of fence, mm-hmm. that we don't have time to go and maintain. And it's not just to help keep your cattle in, but it's also to help other cattle out, you know, vice versa. And you have to be careful too, because I know with the antelope that we have, you know, antelope don't jump fences.
They're underneath it.
And so it's fine to have those spots that you can have the antelope run underneath it. But for the most part, yeah, if you want to help if you want to get on the good side of any rancher and farmer, it's like, hey, I'll come up on a Saturday. I'll mend fence for you. You know, I'll walk this fence and I'll stretch it tight, make sure it's good. Like, you're going to have so much more of a impact on that rancher because you're putting time in. You're not just coming there to hunt their property. You're actually like, hey, developing this partnership with this rancher.
When you figure, so you figure it this way, you're going to, if you put in enough work, you're going to be on an animal. That's the thing.
True.
So the fields are the easy way to do it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's going to be where the food's going to be. That's exactly. Where you're going to see deer. They're going to go in and out of the fields, and you're going to find them off the fields.
Yeah.
It's just going to take you more work to do it. So the work that you're not having to do to get that animal can just as easily be put into being able to hunt that private property. And that's the...
That's a fair trade.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, you know, you're asking for something of monetary value, essentially. You know, you want to figure out what a deer is worth, go shoot one out of season.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, find out pretty quick what the state thinks it's worth. And it's not a little bit amount of money. Yeah. So if you get caught, but no, I think I think that's an important thing as sportsmen. It's how we approach the subjects. If you're going to be the one running around, I just want to shoot something to kill something, and you know, you just a jerk, and you're going to be the guy.
We live in an entitled society, and I think that's what Phil's problem is. He's like, if you're showing up there during hunt season, and you think you're entitled to the animals in my land that I've raised all year, mm-hmm. I'm probably going to say no unless I have a sympathetic reason for you, like you're a kid or you're a new hunter. Mm-hmm. Well, and then if I do say yes, you better like stick to your boundaries.
Well, and how many times do you get as a private landowner, especially in the Nevada? So Nevada hunters are a different breed. A lot of them, they start drinking when they get up in the morning, yeah. And they go hunting. And then you're going to go to a rancher and you're going to be, you know, drinking and being stupid. Rancher, yeah, or you don't go to the rancher. And then you start bad-mouthing the rancher because he didn't let you have access to his property. Mm-hmm. I'm like, and that's the thing is, it's the right of the rancher or the property owner to say yes or no.
We live in America, buddy.
100%. It's their right. And so if they say no, you don't know what the reasoning behind it is. Maybe that rancher has kids that's going to be their only opportunity to hunt for the season. And maybe those animals, he's hoping his kid can get on those animals and it's going to be his first buck, you know? And so there's a lot that goes into it. And maybe it's just the fact that, you know, I brought three guys in the last 3 years, and the last 3 years I've had to do $20,000 worth of work to my pivots in the last 3 years because they've shot my pivots.
Left all the guts on the field. Now I have to run over it with my tractor.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's the big thing. I know, Ron, there's a Baker Ranch area, which is kind of a special hunt unit, and Ron talked to that rancher, and you know, how we did it is, which one do you want? Do you care which one I shoot? And the rancher's like, nope. Pick which one you want. Just make sure you pull it off field before you got it. Mm-hmm. And so you did that, and the rancher was happy. And then after that, the rancher's like, hey, let me know if you want to come back up. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty simple if you build those relationships. Yeah. But what I see a lot of guys do is they're young and dumb, mm-hmm. and they go charging in there, and they're like, hey, I want to hunt your property.
Or they trek around the mountains for a couple weeks, and then every single time they come out the mountains, old Phil has a bunch of deer on his field, and he goes, well, Phil's holding all the deer. It's all Phil's fault.
Yeah.
Well, you can find those deer in the mountains. You're just not working hard enough, and just want to give me.
Well, that the deer know what's going on. Like, you got to admit, deer are smarter than
you. They're not dumb.
Like, they know they could be on private property, and they know that they're more safe than they are out on some sagebrush where they know that they can be shot at any time. Like, if they're out in the middle of a pivot, like, unless, you know, they've been shot at a lot, like, they're not going to have any problems.
There's a reason why their eyes are on the side of their head.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, they're prey animal. And so that prey animal makes them, they're super smart about not getting killed, you know, and that's how they survive. And so, but I think it's important. I think it's an important conversation that we have as sportsmen is how we approach these subjects, and what do you do when they say no? And I will tell you, they say no. Maybe next year it's a, hey, I want to be able to hunt that. Hey, is there a way I can maybe do something to be able to come on and hunt this year? And so it's how you approach it. If I come up and say just a negotiation tactic and say, hey, I'd really like to hunt your property. Can I hunt it today?
Yeah, that's not going to fly.
It's really not going to fly. But if I came up 2 or 3 weeks before or even the season before, mm-hmm. maybe I'm up there 1 year and it's the end of the season, I ain't getting anything. Knocking at the door and saying, hey, I'm hoping to be able to hunt this area next year if I have the opportunity to hunt. Is there anything I could do to be able to hunt your property? And then that conversation is, you can think of things. Well, maybe I don't have anything that I need you to do right now, but maybe I can give you a call. And mm-hmm. and then you give them a call and say, hey, I really need some fence done. Or maybe I'm doing a harvest and I could use a hand in this area over here. And so it gives you that opportunity to build the relationship. That relationship is going to build into the ability to be able to hunt properties. And that's just
– you build a relationship with the farmer and ranchers. But though, you also have to remember, you can't always take that for granted too, because they might have their nephew or, you know, their son or daughter come up. It's like, hey, you know, you can hunt, but you're going to have to wait a week after my son comes in and has first dibs, basically.
But that's a part of the relationship building, is there's always a give and take, right? So I don't have a right to hunt that property, mm-hmm. but if you're going to give me the right, it's on your rules. It's on your timeline.
Yep.
And most people, in general, people are pretty understanding. And I think if you approach it the right way, but it's just when you have the attitude of it's mine, I'm entitled to it. Those animals belong to the people. Yeah, they do when they're sitting on somebody else's land. And so, you know.
Yeah, they're still yours. You just can't shoot them over there.
Yeah, you can't shoot them. You got to wait for them to move.
But then you complain about the ranchers, but we're feeding them year round.
Well, and that's the thing is that the ranchers and the sportsmen, the rancher and the sportsman organizations that go and do the conservation stuff, they're the reasons we can hunt. And what I'll tell you is the people that are going and complaining about the ranchers not letting them in are the same people that are sitting home all year, and the only time they go out in the field is the 2 weeks they're going to go hunt.
Yep.
They don't do any of the service projects. They don't do anything to help create a better environment for the animals.
Me and Nick Goley were just joking about this. We're like, man, our phones are sure getting busy now the duck season started. You know, like people that haven't called me all year, like they're starting to come out of the woodwork. Hey, Ron, when are we going to go? Like, where were you at when I was busting my hump, like all my projects, you know? Like,
and we talk about it in our world, in the conservation side, is come to these projects. You want to know honey holes.
Yeah.
People start talking when they're around people that are doing work, right? Or we take them out, especially on the duck hunting side. We do a lot of duck conservation projects. Mm-hmm. You get to see where the ducks are sitting naturally without any pressure on them, where they want to be. Mm-hmm. And so it helps you become a better hunter. You're going to go to areas and you're going to know, like we knew by going out, there's a ton of geese up at Sunnyside this year because we saw the goslings, right? And so we put the nesting boxes in for a reason. And so that goes a long ways. That's part of being a good ethical hunter is you got to put in the work. And it's not just the work of getting yourself ready.
Either on a ranch or on the conservation. Because, like, if you think about this year, I mean, like, the proof's in the pudding. Like, we had two guys come out that only shot one duck last year. They came out to win. They were at every project. Mm-hmm. They were invited to the Sunnyside Duck Opener. And they came out and they shot good ducks with a good experienced duck hunter. We had another guy that's brand new into hunting, and he listens to the podcast, Eric. I'm sure he'll listen again. And he went on his first duck to hunt this year. I made sure he was with an experienced guy. Mm-hmm. That's because he put in the work. If you put in the work, I'm going to take care of
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
If you don't show up, you know, I'll help you out, but I'm not going to take care of you.
Mm-hmm. Well, the cool thing is we've had the opportunity with a podcast and some other things to bring some people into our fold where Ron and I used to take a bunch of new hunters out. All the time. It was on Ron and I, and it was, we'd always have a new hunter in the blind, and we still just about always have a new hunter in the blind. But we're at the point now where other people that were came in under us are now bringing people into the fold. And so the only way you're going to find these people is if you're around the right people. And the way you get around the right people is go and help with conservation projects, yeah. go to your, you know, the CAB meetings and stuff like that, where they're talking about wildlife and management rules and you have a place to speak. Mm-hmm. Those are like-minded people. Those are people that are going to get things done.
Well, and it's sad because as hunters, you know, our voices aren't heard as much because, you know, the fishing game will come in and they'll open up the discussion, but there's no hunters there to talk about what's going on. We have a hard time showing up to things that really will affect us as, you know, on the conservation side.
We'll That's why you in Idaho lost your coyote hunting contest.
We'll show up on Facebook. Huh.
Did you know, like, in Idaho, you're no longer allowed to have coyote hunting contests, yeah, right, Brian?
I think so. But they'll come as soon as Endow or whatever other regulatory agency makes a rule, they'll come and bitch on Facebook about it for the next 6 weeks mm-hmm. because they made a rule, but they never showed up to stop it. Yeah, and so
exactly. That's where hunters lack. That's where we're not.
We all want to go out and shoot animals, and that's all a lot of people want to do. It's I'm going to go and harvest an animal, and that's all I need to do. If you're not showing up to have a seat at the table, mm-hmm. then an anti is going to have your seat.
That's one thing I've learned from being around Brian and Mike Reese and some other mentors in the political world is laws are made by those who show up.
Yep.
And when we started showing up, things started changing. But if you don't show up, then that guy that is there that doesn't have your best interest in mind is going to take away what you love.
Well, and it's interesting too because you get on, there's different like hunting advocacy groups that they'll send emails. Like that's the thing that you send emails to the political. That doesn't do it. Like emails can just be forgotten. If you send an actual letter that you typed up, printed off, put a
something tangible stamp
to the politician. That has more weight.
Or if you show up and you're sitting in front of them.
Well, and here's yeah. what I will tell you. Sitting in a political position, in a political office, if I were to get five different letters that said five different things, mm-hmm. I'm going to look at every letter and I'm going to get to it. Or if I have people come up and testify and they want to make public comment. Every public comment's a little bit different. Awesome. We listen to all of them. Mm-hmm. We move on. We try to make the best decision. When I have a group that comes in and they make the same exact public comment, word for word, and every one of them, after the second one, I quit listening. I don't even count you if mm-hmm. I quit listening because you can tell it's her mentality. It's groupthink. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is Ron and I have seen a big change in the way our Citizens Advisory Board for Wildlife works. So we first started going, the antis were, man, they were powerful and they spoke up and they've tried to make everybody's life miserable. Mm-hmm. Then Ron and I spoke up and kind of put them into their place and used facts and, you know, real statistics to stop things. And the antis quit showing up. Mm-hmm. And then when they do show up, for the most part, they sit there and they keep their mouth shut. And then when we do have an interaction, so I was doing some public comment and we were on a virtual forum. He tried to step on my toes and try to speak up again. He had his 3 minutes already. I shut him down. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you can be quiet now. You've had your turn. But if we don't have somebody there to be the voice in the room, and then the more people we have, mm-hmm. that means we have more voices in the room. So it's, if we have 10 people and they have two,
they're going to listen to our side more powerfully than they're going to listen to their side. It's just facts. It's human nature.
And it's not easy to show up to these meetings. It's always an inconvenient time. They're hard to find when the public forums are. It's a lot like mended a fence. you just don't have time.
The last thing you want
to
do.
It's the last thing you want to do. And like, is it easy to find the Endel cab meetings, Brian?
No, it's one of the, anything on Endel's website is impossible to find.
And so like, you have to put the effort into it. But once you get your heels dug in, you can put the fence line up. Mm-hmm. But you have to show up for it.
Well, the cool thing is you go from being the new guy in the room and you're speaking up and you're being loud and the antis hate you and whatever. So Ron and I had an experience. There were some regulations they want to do around the youth duck hunt. Well, Ron and I are very heavily involved with the youth duck hunting and the youth movement in general. And so the chairman of the board called us and said, I want you guys to look at this and see what you think.
As a hunter.
Well, as the expert in that field. And so you get known for your area of influence, right? And so then your voice becomes not just one of the voices in the room. It becomes one of the more powerful voices in the room. Mm-hmm. And it's because you're showing up. And when you speak, you're speaking of, you know, here's the statistics. Here's what the whys and here's the science behind it versus here's the emotion behind it.
Well, you look at the Pittman Robinson Foundation, right? That was started back in the 30s. No way that could ever pass today. But how much money hunters and, you know, people who've shot have spent.
It's billions.
Billions of dollars. It's amazing. Most people don't realize that. You throw those numbers out and they're appalled. But that same money goes to Lake Mead to help build ramps so that fishermen can fish. And it also helps people that they can go wakeboarding and all those other things. But it's because of Pittman Robertson that's there. And if we lose hunters, you lose that money slowly and slowly. That is used for everybody. And, you know, we have that same problem up in Idaho and other places, or just in general, is that we're beginning to get to the point where we're loving our public lands too much, you know, where you have to have a permit to get into some places just to go for hikes. And it's just because there's, you know, everybody wants that, but someone's got to pay for it.
Well, you guys have a pay for it. Bigger issue in the room, too, is so you guys have, state of Nevada is almost all public land.
Yeah.
In Idaho, there's a lot more private land, but the other thing is the logging companies come in there and they lock up huge swaths of land, and then there's trespass fees and permits and all the other stuff that go along with it. So you guys have some challenges just finding access to things sometimes.
But you also have to remember too that, you might say that those forest, you know, those logging companies, but they're also building a habitat that those deer aren't getting pressured. Just like with us, with landowners, like we're building the population. Like if it wasn't for our fields, I doubt we would see any antelope in that entire valley that we live. And so, you know, you have to realize that, you know, we're doing our part as landowners to help develop that giving a safe place for those.
Yeah. And it takes a big group and a lot of different hands to make it work. Right. And so the funny thing is you look at, so the money, we talk about the money and the Pittman Robertson money and stuff like that. But the number one way that they spend the Pittman Robertson money is through one of the criteria is through state volunteers, right? And so if you go out and volunteer, what is it, $72 an hour or something like that, Ron, they get?
They charge $25 an hour and then it's met three times. So it's $75 an hour.
So $75 an hour for every hour you spend volunteering on a wildlife project. And so when
plus
you start
miles.
Plus mileage, but when you start talking about 30 or 40 guys showing up to a project, but think about it. And it's drive time too. So then you take a full day and you do a full day project, 10 hours, $750 just for that one person. And so when you're sitting there and you're going to chase a deer and that's the only thing you're doing for the season, if you just put in one day of work and every hunter just put in one solid day of work for a wildlife organization, that impact is going to be unstoppable, right?
Change. Or if just one hunter, or if you showed up to one meeting a year.
Yeah.
So just one meeting a year.
Pretty easy. And it's not even what I think's funny is it's not even hard to do because we're out hunting. We're on a deer hunt. Well, maybe I check a guzzler or maybe I check water levels somewhere and I send it back to my primacy agency and say, hey, this is what this guzzler looked like or it was full or it was empty.
Reports while you're fishing.
Do a fishing report. Yeah. And that all counts towards those volunteer hours. Mm-hmm. And you can do your whole trip, you know? And so we're missing opportunities in that environment. But I think we owe it to the ranchers and the farmers to, you know, we owe them a debt of gratitude. And
I think our conservationist groups do as much good as they can, but I think it's like pissing on a fire where the ranchers are the guys that have the fire tenders. You know, like our things is like a piss in the bucket. And if it wasn't for the ranchers, and hats off to you, we wouldn't have our herds in Nevada.
Well, I think, especially in Nevada, you...
Because of the wild horses, because we can't get these stupid wild horses.
They serve two different purposes, really, in Nevada. So in Nevada, it's such a dry state. Mm-hmm. One of the most critical things is water. And so the conservation groups are providing the water for the most part. And then the ranchers are providing a place for them to feed. Mm-hmm. And so... between the two of them, you've got the two most critical items covered. And so we kind of work together. And so we've talked about, you know, bringing ranchers on and bringing, you know, maybe paying to seed certain crops certain times a year and giving us some area. There's programs that the governments come in and the farmers raise certain areas of crops that's specifically for wildlife. Mm-hmm. And those areas they don't harvest. And so those programs are there and they offer incentives, whether it's tags or money or whatever it is. And so we can build a really good working relationship. And if we build it strong enough, these animals are going to do nothing but thrive. Yeah. And so if we give them time to grow and thrive and become a strong herd, then we're going to be able to keep using them year after year. In Nevada, we're on a decline and we've been on a decline for like 30 years.
Really?
And the problem is, it's a money thing. They don't want to not give as many tags because they don't make as much money. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, the farmers and ranchers have gone to the state and said, hey, the deer aren't there. You need to quit. Mm-hmm. And so we managed to bump the number down a little bit this year. Mm-hmm. But when the farmers and ranchers and hunters
and guides
come up and say, there's no deer to hunt, quit giving out tags. At some point, the state needs to stop and say, what's the best management practice?
What's happening? What happened to our deer population?
You know, something else that's really important is like these two guys right here in the room, Jed and Mitchell. Like, if you're a good example for your kids, they're going to carry on that legacy. You know, like, my dad was a big hunter, and we helped with the conservation project through Eagle Scouts, but I never went to a CAB meeting as a kid, and I never saw my dad go, you know, and so... like setting a good example for your kids and showing up to these meetings, you're going to raise the next generation that's going to fight for the rights for, you know, the hunters when you're gone.
Our poor kids, they get the worst end of it because they get drugged to every single project. So it'd be sometimes it'd be Ron and I and our kids.
Yeah. Well, you remember dragging a pipe up the hill, Mitchell, and not Charleston? That was fun.
Well, and it's interesting too, because like an area like Las Vegas, my wife and I were talking about this. What would happen if Lake Mead dried up? What would happen to this valley?
They'd find a lot of dead bodies.
Find a lot of dead bodies.
They already have.
But, like, what would happen if the water dried up in this valley? This valley would basically be a ghost town.
Yeah, right? It'd die.
And it's interesting because they complain about how much water usage farmers do. But like we just talked about it. It's like, yeah, I get it. We use a lot of water to raise our crops for beef, and beef is the big guy that everybody hates because the amount of water it takes.
They put off methane gas. Yeah, they methane. Fart.
I don't know, man. You're talking. I love beef. I love hamburgers.
But the thing is like, but if you realize, like, we're also providing a habitat for the deer. If you want to see deer, you want to see elk. Well, maybe more deer than elk. You got to have the farmers there, because just like you're seeing here, you know, if that ranch up in Caliente, you know, they decide they don't have enough water, where are the deer going to go?
Yeah, and the problem, too, is people complain about the farmers and the water, but they're too stupid to understand if the farmer is not using the water, then they go to the grocery store to empty shelves. True. You know, it's if you don't have the water, you can't grow the crops, and whether it's the most, some of the most miraculous things in the world are the cow and the pig, because they turn grass into steak and rotten food into bacon. I mean, so they have superpowers already. So,
and it's also like you heard about like maybe 4 or 5 years ago about the drought in California, right? All upset. And they're, you know, talking about farmers not more like almond farmers, and they basically said, you know, how much water does one almond take to produce? It's like 5 or 10 gallons of water per almond.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a ridiculous amount of water. And they're complaining about all these farmers who are or have to pull out all their almond orchards because of the lack of water. But then that was a crisis. But I just saw on like some commercial on TV about how, you know, we need to eat more almonds because almonds are so great. California, it's like, who has the biggest voice?
Yeah.
Who has the biggest money?
Because, well, let me ask you a question, man. How do they milk them almonds?
I don't know.
Very small hands.
You can't ever get milk out of them.
I was a dairy farmer, so I know a little thing.
They don't have little things you slip up to the teats.
No. Can you milk a cat, Greg?
But it's just like, who has the most money and who has the biggest voice?
And that's the thing.
And who can convince? Because if you look at, like, where was I going to go with this? Like,
I do that to Brian.
But, like, so if
you're talking about California loving almonds, and that's why they get all their almonds, yeah, even though it consumes water.
Like, who has the biggest voice in, like, showing, like, the non-hunters, like, what do hunters do? And if, like, hypothetically, what if there wasn't any hunters in Wisconsin? Like whitetail deer.
Oh, there'd be no crops left in Wisconsin.
Isn't there a place where there's so many, like, so many deer that, like it causes more road injuries than anything else?
Yeah.
Is that Wisconsin?
Take State Farm. Like, look up State Farm and how many deer get hit. Because they keep track of that because that's money in their pocket. And so why isn't State Farm promoting hunting in areas
where the biggest mortality rate for bear is in the state of Nevada?
Bear. Then we always had bear.
We do. So we can now hunt bear in the state of Nevada very rarely.
Oh, up in Ruby Valley.
It's the hardest tag to get. But the number one mortality for a bear in the state of Nevada is a car. Mm-hmm. And they're complaining about the hunters. And the hunters cars take out 10 times. 10 times the bears that a hunter ever will in the state of Nevada. And so it's just, and it's tough. And it's, we have to have a voice in the room. Mm-hmm. But if nobody's willing to step up and be the voice, then we'll never get ahead of that.
You also have to be the voice in the room, but you also have to be a logical voice in the room. It's like, you can't just go up to some vegan and say, I like to hunt because that's what my dad did. And that's what my grandpa did. It's like, no, we're managing these herds, this population, to make sure that they're in check. And it's also talk about how, yeah, I can't just go out and shoot with any type of gun. You know, there's all the regulations that I've got to do. It's like, it has to be the right size. I can only have so many shells in my gun. You know, like, most people who don't hunt don't understand that they say, oh, those dumb hunters are just going to go out and drink beer and they're going to just shoot all the ducks.
We had an interesting conversation at the CAM meeting last month. Remember, they're taking away the youth tags. And I talked about bringing my kid up to Area 10. And we have a couple anti-hunters on the board. And I was like, we're rarely accessible in Area 10, but my kid's able to go out there every year and hunt. And this one anti-hunter goes, well, wouldn't the youth not want to go up and hunt anymore if he's never successful? And, like, Paul Dixon looks at him and goes, you don't get it. Mm-hmm. That's what he looked at him. He's like, but it's not about the hunting.
Yeah,
it's about getting out with your kids. And a lot of dads won't get out with their kids unless they have something to do.
Well, I know a guy that skydiving place, but we're at. He's one of the guys that comes, and we were talking one day, and he knows what we do, and he's like, he's a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. He's a vegetarian hunter.
Vegetarian hunter.
He enjoys being able to go out and hunt. Mm. He doesn't eat the meat. He gives the meat away, but that's an activity that he enjoys. Mm. He understands it. But he also is a little weird because he's like, plants have feelings and emotions. And,
yeah.
You know, so, but at the same point, you can't, what bothers me with a lot of times with hunters is we're going to flaunt it and we're going to push it in front of people's faces. We probably shouldn't push it in front of, right? And so if we kind of moderate ourselves a little bit, it'll be a lot easier for us to get things done because we've given a little bit and then we've let them kind of feel like they've won a little bit. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to lose every battle.
Same as Donald Trump. If he had just kept his mouth shut in office, he'd probably still be president.
Well, I think he did a lot of good things, but I think he was an arrogant ass. But
he did. Like, he did a lot of good things. He was I love him. I love his policies. I love everything he did. And I was like, man, just let's tone it down a little bit. And we're going to be okay.
I just don't like the man he is. That's all. I like what he did. And I think he did a really good job when he was there.
But it goes same for the hunters, right?
Yeah.
Don't put a dead, don't put your, old Jed up here holding a dead doe head with blood coming out of it on Facebook. You're going to trigger tons of people. Just don't Donald Trump your hunting experience.
I know it's a popular thing and people have their traditions and putting blood on the war paint on and all this other stuff. But imagine how that makes you look to that anti-hunter group. And
then I could do what I want.
I could do what I want. I don't care about those people, but those people are people writing.
Don't give them ammunition, policy. Man. Just give them ammunition.
Yeah. Those people are the ones that are writing policy. And so just be tasteful what you do. I mean, you're still going to be able to do things if you can work your way. You're going to catch more flies with honey than you are with vinegar, right? And so
I'm not saying to stop hunting. I'm not saying to stop taking pictures. I'm not saying, stop your traditions. Just don't post them where they're going to trigger people. Yeah. That's it.
I mean,
it's easy.
We all remember.
Why do you need to?
Yeah, we all remember the day tying.
Unless you like the drama. People love drama.
True.
Tying the deer to the front of the truck and driving down the road. But those years are gone, right?
China.
Throw them in the back of the truck, throw them in China. A cooler. First off, you run around with a deer and it's hot and then you wonder why it tastes like garbage when you get it home. Or you lose so much meat when you take it to the butcher because you don't want to do it yourself. You lose so much meat. Well, it's because half of it was spoiled because you threw it in the back of the truck and drove around with it for 3 days.
Yeah.
Butcher it, throw it in a cooler. You keep your your rack and stuff just so you can do your taxidermy and stuff like that.
Dude, do you know who's a great example of doing it?
Who's that?
Steve Ranella. Mm-hmm. He is famous. Even vegans love him. But it's because he does it so tasteful. He does it very artfully. Everybody loves to see what he's cooking. He's a great example. Be like Steve Ranella.
Well, and it's funny because you look at things that we don't think of as hunters because it's part of what we have to do, right? Rydell is a perfect example at the carp rodeo. So we had an anti, and it was the carp rodeo. We're trying to get the carp out of this lake, as many of us can. So they do once a year, they come catch as many carp. So he came, and he's got Field the Grill. So if you haven't gone and seen Rydell and Field the Grill, you should. But he cooks different wild game. And so it's from the field to the grill. Field. It's his grocery stores everywhere, right? So he's got these carp, and these carp are almost impossible to kill. And he's smacking them over the head with like a mallet or something like that. And this lady's like, isn't there an easier way to do that? And he's like, no.
And then also he fillets a carp.
Have you ate a carp before? Yeah.
No.
No. What stories have you heard about carp? How do you eat them?
It's just nasty.
You put it on the shingle and you cook it on the shingle and you eat the shingle. There's always that joke. And so he's out there. He's filleting carp. And he's cooking it into tacos. And Lay's like, that's all you're going to take from that fish? And he's like, no one eats these. Why are you mad at me?
Most people. So before, this is the first year Rydell came out and cooked. The other years, they bring in a giant dumpster and everybody just chucked their fish in the dumpster, right? Or Ron would take him home and bury him under his tree. But he made carp tacos, and everybody loved the carp tacos. So there's a lot of stigmas, and he swears that coot is one of the greatest. It tastes like liver.
Good as spaghetti.
Yeah, I can't do it, but he loves it, and he cooks every game you could imagine. And he's always training. He's like, hey, I want a coyote.
I want to eat coyote.
Give me a coyote. And so,
hey, but let me ask you a question. Being real, if you had to cook it, would you try it?
I would try it.
Would you try it, Jed?
Probably, yeah.
Well, last winter, Jed shot a jackrabbit, and we cooked it up. And we ate it. Then it's like, how many people eat jackrabbit?
Well,
it was like during Christmas break.
Yeah,
but why not?
And it was good.
It's stigma. Is all
like,
it
granted,
is.
Granted, my wife put it in like a. It's a pot. She made it a pot pie. So you really couldn't tell that it was jackrabbit. But I told that to a guy that we hunt with, and he was like, jackrabbit? It's like,
so
you would never know.
We see burro. And burro is one of the best meats you can eat.
So is horse.
Yes, I'm sure horse is amazing.
Yeah, talk to the French about horse.
But there's a stigma. We don't eat dogs in the United States.
I don't eat dogs.
And horse, but
I lived in the Philippines.
Most cultures, a lot of other cultures, do eat the animals. We don't.
I'll tell you how other cultures work in the Philippines. If you get drunk enough, does it have meat on it?
Yeah.
And you're going to eat it.
Well, and my buddy.
One of my favorite things.
Is it protein that you can't get anywhere else?
One of my favorite things is we used to stomp on the mice field, and these little bugs used to come up. They looked like, I don't know, they're called sun bugs. And man, they were delicious.
But I have a buddy that went down to South America. He did a backpacking trip for a couple years and ate guinea pig when he was down there. And that's a delicacy. But here.
Have you ever hunted guinea pig in the wild?
No.
That's not real.
No. But it's because there's that stigma that we've put these as pets and these as food. And, you know, it's funny. There's that PETA sign that says, where do you draw the line? And the guy goes right about there, you know. But
and then they go, have you seen this? It says, depends on what country you're on. You draw the line in the Philippines, like, the line's all the way behind it. Like, yeah.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, we get around Easter time down here, and then you probably get it somewhat up there. Is everyone wants to get their kids a bunny or a chick, and then what do? They take them to the animal shelter in 3 weeks.
They let them go in the park,
or they'll go in the park.
Have you seen that sign at Floyd Land Park where they're like, "Don't let your bunnies go."
Well, and the other thing is, like, we have out where we're at, so it's a roosters. There's a reservoir, and they go release their roosters at the reservoir.
Or it's even worse that you can see horses that have brands on them out there with the wild horses. So it's just like
goldfish too.
Yeah, goldfish. We have some ponds that are inundated with people throwing their goldfish, or we've had piranhas show up places, and you know,
alligators in Lake Mead.
Well, yeah, there's some gators in Lake Mead that they've seen supposedly. So
dead bodies.
Jimmy Hoffa, you know.
But it's just interesting too, because like with like the horses, it's like I actually talked to someone who's pro horse and talked about how much money the US government is spending to keep these horses alive. It's like, couldn't this be spent someplace else?
Well, if you just gave them the pictures that from the last roundup they did up at Mount Charleston up here, where 90% of the roundup had to be euthanized because they're in such poor body condition. They're telling me that they're doing good things for these horses by protecting them.
Yeah. Or the fact that you're losing wild animals because the horses will stick around that water hole and won't let anything else get in.
Oh, they'll stomp it. They'll stomp that water hole to nothing. We had a guzzler, not even the wild horses, but we have some maverick cattle too. Mm-hmm. And during the summer, this thing would be completely dry. Mm-hmm. So we fenced it in and excluded all the cows and horses out of there. Uh-huh. And now that thing stays full year round, it's amazing, really? Right? So they take a lot of water. And so they take the resources from the animals that were naturally on the landscape. They're introduced. They're not a native animal.
Yeah.
And you look at, I don't know if you've gone up to around the Reno area where the government has their holding pens.
No, I've heard about them. Yeah.
There's 5,000 or 6,000 wild horses in these holding pens. Mm-hmm. So what are we going
to
do?
Is that right on the way to Washoe?
I gotta think where I was going. Yeah, I think so. It's up.
Drove past that, Mitchell. Remember that horse ranch?
Yeah. But it's all on government dime to keep those.
It's all on government dime. And you think those horses are happy being in those facilities?
Well, and also, like, the price of feed, like, we're doing really good as farmers because the price of hay is way up. But, like, there were literally ranchers who were trying to get rid of cows last year because of the price of feed, and there was no grazing ground, that they shut down feedlots, not feedlots, but feed cells, because they were just getting inundated with so many ranchers trying to bring their cows because they couldn't feed them. They couldn't afford them, couldn't afford buying hay. There's no place for them to go out on the range to feed. And so they basically shut down some of the cell yards because they were just getting inundated from people from northern Nevada trying to get rid of their
cattle. It was so bad for a while for the livestock market. A buddy of mine owns a pig farm out here, and he sold his pigs after 4 months for less than what he paid for them when he bought them. Mm-hmm. And so, and then he had to feed them for those 4 months. But that's a problem that people don't understand is when the hay prices and the feed prices get so high that the ranchers start offloading animals, the sale price on those animals plummets. And I've been to the point where now we've had issues with some neighbors and stuff where you'll get in and you'll get some crossbred cattle, and people don't understand the importance of fixing that fence.
Exactly.
Is $23 a hundred is what we were getting for cattle.
Really? $23.
$23 a hundred for crossbred cattle at one point in time.
Black.
And so we're Herefords. We run Herefords. Okay. And so when you start getting them crossed, nobody wants them. They don't make good beef cattle. And so, and then you get days where you might get a hundred, you know, it's just, but it depends on the market, and you never know what it's not like you know, I'm a car manufacturer and I know what the market's going to be a year in advance. As a farmer, I don't know what the weather is going to do. I don't know what my herd loss is going to be. I don't know any of that stuff until the middle of the season. And I can't change. I just can't pivot and change instantly.
See, a lot of that problem with the crossbred is having bulls. And we've had bulls that we've owned. And, you know, if there's a cow in heat, that bull will go whatever it takes to get to that cow. The same way with elk too. Like, you get in that rut and those bulls don't have anything else. No sense.
Nothing's going to stop them.
Nothing's going to stop them.
I think we're the same way though. I've been to bars.
different podcast. Well, I want to go hunting tomorrow, man. So,
all right. We're
getting pretty close.
You about done, you think?
I can't talk anyways, dude. You've ran me too hard these last
You're going to go. You're gonna go miss a bunch of ducks tomorrow. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'll send you pictures. How many I miss?
Well, just empty boxes of shells. That's the way he normally does it. All right. Well, thank you guys. Thank you, Jeff, for coming in. It's hanging out with us. Mitchell, Phil, thanks for coming by.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you out there this weekend, man.
Yeah, so we'll see you too.
We'll have a. Hopefully, you guys have a great hunt. You know, if you're going to go out this weekend, why don't you take somebody with you if you can? If you can't take, if you're going to take somebody with you, make sure you try to teach them something. If you can't take somebody or teach somebody, make sure you hunt hard.